It was nearly 7 when he finally closed his paper-stuffed briefcase, picked it up with a groan, and headed for the elevator. He dropped into the seat of his car, his mind still churning on his work. The next thing he knew, he was pulling into his driveway 25 minutes later. He switched off the engine and sat listening to the clink, clink, clink of the cooling engine. He wished there were an ignition key that would switch off his mind. Was he wasting his time with these daily lunchtime lessons and laws of stratospheric success he was supposedly learning? Was any of this getting him closer to making that third quarter quota he so badly needed to make? He looked at the front door of his suburban duplex and sighed. Susan would have been home for an hour already. She would be just as exhausted as he was, and her afternoon would have been just as hard as his. He found Susan in the kitchen, pulling something from the oven. She didn't need to tell him that he was late, or that their dinner was a little dried out, or that she was too tired to care one way or the other. Her body language said all that and more. Over a listless dinner, notes were compared and miseries tallied as the two moved through the meal and kitchen cleanup. Joe wanted to tell her all about his appointment at the imposing Liberty office building, but he gave up without even trying. Last Saturday, when Joe had returned home and told her his first impressions of Pindar, Susan had been intrigued. But at dinner on Monday, when he tried to tell her about Ernesto, she said only, "So this guy is actually the owner?" She repeated this a few times and couldn't seem to get any deeper into his story. Yesterday, when he started telling her about Nicole Martin's kindergarten conference room, she rolled her eyes and said, "You're kidding." It went no further. Joe and Susan had established a sort of unwritten rule. They both had high-stress jobs and would arrive home for the evening in knots, each with at least a solid hour or two of extra office work to do. The unwritten rule was this: we each get up to 30 minutes of complaint time, no more. Tonight, Susan was already well into her half hour. Joe sat on the edge of their bed, doing his best to stay sympathetic, while Susan paced and talked. Inwardly, he sighed again, wondering what he could possibly say that would make her feel better. Suddenly, Joe realized that Susan had stopped talking, mid-sentence, and was looking at him. "I'm sorry," she said softly. "It's almost 8:30. A tired sigh. "I guess I'm a bottomless pity party." A wan attempted a smile. "I know, you've got work to get to." She turned away and said, more to herself than to him, "Fair's fair." Joe opened his mouth to speak, then closed it again. Fair's fair. What did that remind him of? And why did it sound so wrong? 50-50 is a losing proposition. It was Sam, of course. Even Stephen. "I scratched your back, so now you owe me." That's not being a friend. That's being a creditor. Was that what their marriage had become? Without thinking about what he was going to say, he blurted out, "No, Suze, wait. Actually, I don't." She turned back and looked at him. "Please, go on," he said. "I'd like to hear about what happened. Really." For a moment, Susan looked as if Joe had told her that the laws of gravity had just been revoked. "Really?" "Sure," he said. "I mean, it sounds like it was pretty rough. So what did you do?" His wife sat next to him on the bed and looked at him again. "Really," he said, "my stuff will wait." Susan slowly began to talk again about her day, about an especially nasty conflict she was having with a co-worker. After a few minutes, she stopped mid-sentence again and looked at Joe. He nodded and waited for her to go on. She lay back against the pillow and began to pour her heart out. She talked about how long this difficult situation at work had been brewing, why it hurt her so, how lost she was as to what to do about it, how it made her feel. 20 minutes later, she was crying. Joe was mortified. He'd been listening carefully, but she'd talked about so many different issues and covered so much ground, he wasn't sure exactly which thing she was crying about. It seemed as if, for Susan, everything was wrong. He lay down and put his arm around her awkwardly, but her weeping continued. He murmured a few attempts at words of comfort, feeling foolish all the while. What was it Gus had said? "Sometimes you feel foolish, even look foolish, but you do the thing anyway." Finally, her sobbing turned to sniffling, and then that stopped too. Joe felt immense relief. Perhaps his words were not so foolish after all. They seemed to have given her some comfort, at least. Perhaps she was just thinking. Hey, he said. Love you. Susan said nothing. Suze? He stirred her gently. She was asleep. She hadn't heard any of his words of comfort. She'd just cried herself to sleep. Feeling useless and defeated, Joe quietly got himself ready for bed and slipped under the covers. Wrapped in a quiet ache for Susan's misery and wishing he could have done something to take away its sting, he eventually drifted off. The next morning, he awoke with a start and lurched from deep sleep into sudden horrified realization. Yesterday's lesson! What was it? Sam Rosen? Networking? An army of personal walking ambassadors. The law of influence. He had gone from work to home to bed and passed the night away without even thinking about the day's lesson, let alone trying to apply it. He groaned and grabbed his pillow, meaning to throw it across the room in frustration. But as he did, he realized that Susan was not in the bed next to him. He glanced at the clock. 8:15. He'd overslept. Susan must have crept out of bed and left the house without talking to him, without even bothering to wake him. He groaned again. He'd blown Pindar's lesson, he was late for work, and he was on the outs with Susan. 3 strikes, Joe, he muttered. Pindar's words echoed in his mind. If you don't abide by my condition, our meetings will come to an end. He dragged himself upright with sinking thoughts about calling Brenda to cancel his lunch appointment with Pindar. And then he glanced at Susan's pillow and noticed a piece of paper, folded in half, with a single word written on the outside. Sweetheart. When was the last time Susan had called him that? Come to think of it, when was the last time Susan had written him a note? He picked it up and opened it. My sweet Joe, I hope I succeeded in slipping out without waking you. You deserve the extra rest after the earful I gave you last night. Thank you so much. Thank you for your generosity. Generosity? My sweet Joe. He read the rest of the note. I can't remember ever feeling so listened to, so heard. I love you. S. Joe was at a loss. Generosity? What had he been generous about? He looked back at the note, scanning it for answers. Thank you for your generosity. I can't remember ever feeling so listened to. He rubbed his face, amazed. It wasn't about complaining at all. She just wanted him to listen, just wanted to be heard. All at once, he remembered that voice like a creaking gate hinge. Stop keeping score. And then he laughed. He had done the homework. Chapter 10, The Law of Authenticity. What was it like? They were the first words either had spoken the whole 15 minutes they'd been on the road into town. Much like yesterday, when he'd been unable to stop thinking about the office, Joe was now having a hard time tearing his mind away from Susan's note and her tearful aria of woes the night before. Pindar's query caught him off guard. Sir? Joe didn't think he'd call Pindar Sir since their first meeting. Applying the third law, said Pindar. What was that like for you? It occurred to Joe that up to this point, Pindar had never once asked him anything about his homework or checked to make sure he was fulfilling the condition. So why was he asking now? A glance at Pindar told him the man wasn't checking up on him. He was asking because he genuinely wanted to know. It's because he knows something happened, he thought, something important. It went okay. I mean, I think it did. Honestly, I'm not sure. Pindar nodded, as if Joe's response made complete sense. These lessons don't apply only to business, Joe. A genuinely sound business principle will apply anywhere in life. In your friendships, in your marriage, anywhere. That's the true bottom line. Not whether it simply improves your financial balance sheet, but whether it improves your life's balance sheet. I guess I never thought about that before. I highly recommend it. He glanced sideways at Joe. My wife and I, remember, have been married for nearly 50 years. 50 years, Joe echoed. 50 years. The man's marriage had lasted nearly twice Joe's current lifespan. Now, this is going to sound very old-fashioned. Pindar glanced at Joe again, as if looking for confirmation that Joe understood this. Okay, Joe said, nodding. I believe there is one reason, and only one reason, that we have stayed together so long and are as happy together today as we were 48 years ago. More so, in fact. That reason is this. I care more about my wife's happiness than I do about my own. All I've ever wanted to do since the day I met her is make her happy. And here's the truly remarkable thing. She seems to want the same thing for me. Wouldn't some people call that codependent? Ventured Joe. Yes, some people probably would. Know what I call it? Happy? Pindar laughed. Yes, certainly that. I was going to say, I'd call that success. Success. Joe thought about his life with Susan and how it had begun to feel like a constant drama of battle and compromise. 50-50 is a losing proposition. Like what Sam says about networking, he commented. Exactly. Pindar pointed out the windshield. And here we are. Joe saw the huge auditorium looming ahead and turned into the underground parking lot. They were going to hear the keynote speaker at an annual sales symposium. It was one of the city's largest events, and it attracted participants from all over the country. Today's speaker, though, was a local resident. Her name was Deborah Davenport. The place was packed, but Pindar had reserved two seats for them at the back of the large hall. Joe was impressed by the size of the crowd. He guessed there were a good 3,000 people waiting to hear the speaker. And she did not disappoint. After the symposium's master of ceremonies gave a brief, glowing introduction, the speaker stepped center stage to a standing ovation from the crowd. She waited gracefully until they had finished their applause and seated themselves. 12 years ago, I turned 42, she began. I got three presents for my birthday. One, my best friend gave me $100 gift certificate to J.C. Penney, which in those days was the high watermark of my fashion existence. She paused, looked to the right and to the left, then leaned forward toward the audience and struck a confidential, just between you and me, pose. And by the way, she added, J.C. Penney is still my number one fashion experience. This was greeted by a round of laughter and applause. She grinned and waved everyone quiet. I mean, why throw your money away on overpriced fashion that'll just be obsolete next year? Am I right? Besides, ladies, she tapped her index finger a few times to her temple. It's what's inside that makes you beautiful, not the wrapping. Another wave of laughter and applause rushed through the place. We're 60 seconds in, and she owns the room, Joe marveled to himself. Deborah Davenport continued. Two. My three kids pooled their money and got their mom an all-day, all-expense-paid retreat at a spa downtown. I mean, the expensive kind. All day. And they planned it so they had enough left over to pay the babysitter. In fact, for just a breath, she wavered and seemed about to cry. In fact, they had called her and set it up so she'd be there all day without my finding out ahead of time. Which, knowing how nosy their mom can be, was a miracle of administrative genius and first-rate sneakiness. The crowd laughed a warm rustle of appreciation. Three. My husband gave me the most surprising gift of all. He gave me the wake-up call of a lifetime when he walked out the door and never came back. Joe felt the room take a breath and hold it. It took me one full year to unwrap, open, understand, and use that gift. She looked around, and Joe saw that she was meeting the eyes of individual after individual, not only in the first few rows, but throughout the crowded auditorium. Today, I want to share that gift with every one of you. For the next 15 minutes, the speaker took them through her story. At 42, suddenly single and with three kids to feed, Deborah had never spent a day in the mainstream workforce. As a full-time mother, wife, and manager of a busy household, she had juggled dozens of skills and worked grueling hours, but as she quickly learned, none of what she'd spent the last 20-odd years doing was considered marketable. Everywhere I applied, she told the audience, I was overage and underqualified. After her husband left town, she spent the next few months pursuing a real estate license. Deborah was a quick study and passed the exam on her first try. The following 8 or 9 months were busy with learning and trying to follow all the advice and teaching of those in her firm. They taught me every kind of sales methodology and closing technique ever invented, I learned the direct close, the deal concession close, the time-driven close, and the trial offer close. They taught me the compliment close and the embarrassment close, the best time to buy close and the never the best time to buy close, the courtship close and the shame close. I learned every close from A to Z. She paused, looked around, then deadpanned. Oh, you don't believe me? A ripple of laughter went through the first few rows. Joe guessed there were some Deborah Davenport fans who already knew whatever riff might be coming next. Well, let's see, she began, then started counting them on her fingers. There was the assumptive close, the bonus close, the concession close, the distraction close, the emotion close, the future close. The people in the first row began to clap in rhythm, one clap to each new letter of the alphabet. The Golden Bridge close, the humor close, the IQ close, the Jersey City close. And now the whole audience joined in, marking each beat with a loud clap. The kill clause close, the leveraged asset close, the money's not everything close, the now or never close, the ownership close, the puppy dog close, the quality close, the reversal close, the standing room only close, the takeaway close, the underpriced value close, the vanity close, the window of opportunity close. And she took a big breath. The Zaviera Hollander close, Yaga Sisterhood close, and Zsa Zsa Gabor close. Honey, I learned how to close. The rhythmic clapping dissolved into a huge round of applause as everyone laughed and cheered at her bravura performance. She held her hands up, eyes twinkling, until the laughter and clapping died down. And let me tell you what happened. At the end of a year, I had not sold one single solitary property. And I hated it. Every single desperate, failing minute of it. The hall was silent. That Thursday, I turned 43. For this birthday, my best friend bought me a ticket to a sales symposium. Tell you the truth, I didn't want to go. But she was my best friend. She smiled. Still is, by the way. And she beamed down at the front row, where Joe guessed the woman in question was seated. So what could I do? She's awfully persuasive. Laughter from a cluster of women in front confirmed Joe's guess. I went to the symposium. She looked around, as if suddenly recognizing where she was for the first time. Actually, it was this symposium. Matter of fact, I sat right where you all are sitting right now, on a Thursday afternoon in September, just like this one. That year, the keynote speaker was a man I'd never heard of before. He talked about the importance of adding value to what you sell. Whatever it is you sell, he told us, even if it's a mundane commodity that everyone else is selling too, whether it's real estate, insurance, or hot dogs. And with a chill, Joe realized that Ms. Davenport was talking about the man sitting next to him. Whatever it is, he said, you can excel by adding value. If you need money, he said, add value. And if you need a lot of money, add a lot of value. Now, people in the audience laughed when he said that, but I didn't see anything funny. I was sitting way in the back, feeling just awful about my life. Somehow I got up the courage to raise my hand. His eyes lit right on me, and he said, "Yes, the woman in back." And I stood up and said, "What if you need a lot of money fast?" He nodded, smiled, and said, "Then find a way to add a lot of value fast." The audience responded with a quiet ripple of laughter. Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you, I thought about what he said all that weekend. I thought about it hard. What value could I possibly add to a real estate listing by a failed broker in a buyer's market? Sunday evening, it came to me. What could I possibly add? Nothing. There was not one single solitary shred or ounce of value I could think of that insignificant little Deborah Davenport could add. After a year of trying, I'd proven I had no professional value whatsoever. What I had to offer these clients was nothing. That Sunday evening, I made up my mind. It was time to quit. She paused. She paused again, took a breath to steady her emotion. She tapped her finger on her temple again and looked out at the group. You understand what was going on in here? When my husband walked out that door, my self-esteem got up and walked out with him. Joe noticed hundreds of heads nodding. She was touching a powerful chord. My husband had seen me more as a liability than as an asset. The job market had agreed with him, and obviously so did the world of real estate. Who was I to argue the point? Joe glanced around and noticed quite a few damp pairs of eyes. What mysterious power did this woman hold over them? Deborah Davenport gave a slow, sad shake of her head. A year later, and I still hadn't unwrapped my birthday gift. She took a sharp breath and let it out again, as if to shake off the mood. So I went in the next morning ready to clean out my desk. I had one last appointment that I couldn't weasel out of, so purely out of obligation, I met the prospect and drove her to see the house. It's already over, I told myself, so what the heck? I just let myself have a good time with her. I let go of all the techniques. I didn't even bring spec sheets in the house. She clucked disapprovingly. On the way over, we just chattered, talked about everything and anything, silly stuff. I couldn't tell you for sure whether I even told her the asking price. It was the most unprofessional, sloppy, irresponsible, disgraceful sales presentation in the history of real estate. She held up both hands in an attitude of exasperation, as if to say, "What a ditz, huh?" And of course, she bought the house. It took a full minute for the applause to die down enough for her to go on with her story. I learned something that day. When I said that my life as a mom, wife, and household manager left me with nothing the marketplace wanted, I was wrong. There was something else I'd learned over those years, and that was how to be a friend, how to care, how to make people feel good about themselves. And that, my friends, is something the marketplace wants very much. Always has, always will. The speaker at that symposium had said, "Add value." I had nothing to add but myself. And apparently, that was exactly what had been missing. She paused and took a deep breath, giving her feelings a moment to settle. "I've sold a few more homes since then," she began, and an appreciative wave of laughter went through the audience. Everyone present knew Deborah Davenport's sales record. "A few more homes" was probably the understatement of the decade. Later I met the husband of the woman I sold that first house to, and he connected me to some friends who were getting involved in commercial real estate. I'd said I would never do that. Wrong again. Deborah Davenport's comment, "and he connected me to some friends," touched a loose thread in Joe's mind, something he'd meant to ask a few days earlier but had forgotten about until now. He leaned over to Pindar and whispered, "The connector?" Pindar smiled and nodded. "Aha," thought Joe. "So it was Deborah Davenport who sold Ernesto, the enterprising cafe owner, his multi-million-dollar commercial properties. When would he get to meet this connector character? "And I've had the honor of being named this city's top realtor in both residential and commercial markets." Joe's mind was still buzzing. If it was this connector who had linked up Ernesto Iafrate and Deborah Davenport and had helped arrange the financing for Nicole Martin's fledgling software business, he leaned over again and whispered, "Who are we going to meet tomorrow?" Pindar whispered, "Ah, the Friday guest," he nodded to himself. "The Friday guest is a surprise." "It's the connector, isn't it?" Joe asked. "I'm finally going to meet the connector." Pindar just smiled and wouldn't say another word. "And in the past few years," Deborah Davenport was saying, "I've crisscrossed the country speaking to groups just like this group today, and I tell every one of them the same thing. I'm here because I have the awesome responsibility and honor of selling you something far more valuable than a house. What I'm here to sell you on is you. People, remember this. No matter what your training, no matter what your skills, no matter what area you're in, you are your most important commodity. The most valuable gift you have to offer is you. Reaching any goal you set takes 10% specific knowledge or technical skills, 10% max. The other 90%+ is people skills. And what's the foundation of all people skills? Liking people, caring about people, being a good listener? Those are all helpful, but they are not the core of it. The core of it is who you are. It starts with you. As long as you're trying to be someone else or putting on some act or behavior someone else taught you, you have no possibility of truly reaching people. The most valuable thing you have to give people is yourself. No matter what you think you're selling, what you're really offering is you. She glanced toward the back of the hall, and Joe was startled to realize that she was looking directly at him. Or at least, it certainly seemed like it to Joe. "You want great people skills?" She leaned in toward the audience as if confiding something to her best friend. "You want people skills?" she repeated. "Then be a person." She looked around from face to face. "Can you do that? Will you do that?" She looked to the left, and then to the right again, meeting the gaze of dozens of individuals. "It's worth 10,000 times more than all the closing techniques that have ever been or ever will be invented. It's called authenticity." Joe remembered wondering what mysterious power this woman held over them, and knew he had just heard the answer. They pulled out of the parking garage in silence and threaded their way through the downtown maze. Joe had thought about many things in the last few days and had reevaluated much about the way he did business. But he had not been prepared for the impact that Deborah Davenport had on him with that single word. Authenticity. He glanced over at Pindar's impassive expression, unreadable as the Sphinx, then back at the road. "You know why I came to see you Saturday?" Pindar nodded. "You were hungry to learn about success, genuine success." Joe paused, then said, "Actually, no, not really. The truth is..." Pindar glanced at him, his eyes serious. "Go on." Joe took a breath. "I came to see you because I wanted to impress you. I wanted to gain your trust. And I was hoping, planning actually, to persuade you to help me put this deal together. This deal I'm working on. To bring your money and connections and, you know..." Joe's voice dropped to an almost inaudible confession. "Your clout." There it was. He'd said it. And now it was out in the open. His reason for coming to see the man in the first place. The BK account. Clout and leverage. Joe had never seen Pindar angry. He certainly didn't want to see it now. Nevertheless, he took another breath, then forced himself to turn back and look his mentor in the eye. "It was a stupid reason," Joe said. Pindar spoke softly. "No, not stupid. It's where you were, that's all. Besides... that wasn't the reason you came to see me. You only thought it was the reason you came to see me." Joe stared at him. "Then what was the real reason I came?" Pindar smiled. "You were hungry to learn about success. Genuine success." The fourth law, the law of authenticity. The most valuable gift you have to offer is yourself.
Chapter 11. Gus. Gus left Joe alone that afternoon. He sensed the younger man needed some space. He didn't know exactly what had happened, but he suspected that Joe was experiencing the cleansing pain of honest self-reflection. As 5 o'clock approached, Gus closed up his desk, switched off his lamp, gathered up his things, and padded over to pluck his tweed jacket from the coat rack. "Gus?" He turned and saw Joe looking at him. "Hmm?" The young man looked pensive. No, it was more. He looked positively contrite. "You have a minute?" Gus left his jacket on the rack. "Sure." He took a seat next to Joe's desk, folded his hands, and looked up. Joe came around the desk, pulled a chair over, and sat down next to Gus. "I need to tell you something." Joe paused. Gus waited. "You've been good to me ever since I first got here. And I've always thought of you as, well, a little naive. Old-fashioned, you know?" Gus nodded. "I never believed the rumors about you," said Joe. "I mean the ones about them just keeping you on out of loyalty. And I never believed the other rumors either, the ones about how successful you've been. But that part's true, isn't it? These 5 laws, all Pindar stuff about giving, you know all this stuff, don't you?" Gus regarded Joe for a moment before answering. "I have been very fortunate in my career," he began. "And yes, I have been to the Stone Mansion and learned those same lessons you've been learning this week." Gus looked at his hands, then back at Joe. "Let's see. Today being Thursday, I'm going to guess that you've just heard about the 4th law of stratospheric success?" Joe nodded. "Authenticity. And now I'm supposed to figure out some way to apply it." Gus pursed his lips thoughtfully. "Well, seems to me, perhaps you just did." Joe stared at Gus for what seemed like an entire minute. Gus smiled back, unblinking. "It's you, isn't it?" Joe said softly. "You're the connector." Gus unfolded his hands, leaned back in his chair, scratched his head, looked out the window, then looked back at Joe and spread out his hands. "You got me. I met our friend Pindar 35 years ago, introduced him to Sam Rosen a few years later. A few years after that, I invested a few dollars and bought both men hot dogs at a neighborhood stand I knew about. That hot dog lunch turned out to be a very productive investment." He gave Joe a moment to digest this information, then continued. "A little over 10 years ago, I introduced Ernesto Iafrate and his wife to Deborah Davenport, the woman who sold my wife our house. Unless I miss my guess, you probably heard her speak earlier today." Dazed, Joe just nodded. "A few years later, when some young friends of mine wanted to form their own software company, I introduced them to Sam, who gave them financial advice. Sam, Pindar, and I invested in Nicole Martin's little venture, and we did well, just as we did with Iafrate's cafe." Noting Joe's open-mouthed stare, Gus laughed a little self-consciously. "I don't know. I just keep finding good horses to back. I've always been pretty lucky that way." He looked Joe in the eye, and Joe understood that he was saying he considered Joe to be one of those good horses, too, and that it had nothing whatsoever to do with luck. I don't get it," Joe blurted out. "Forgive me for putting this so bluntly, but you must be worth millions." Gus gazed at Joe with an intensity Joe had never seen in the old man's face before. "This is something I consider very, very private, but I'd like to share it with you now and trust that this will be confidential between us. My net worth." Joe nodded. Gus named a figure. Joe's knees went weak. "But why do you still work here? Why do you still work at all?" Before Gus could answer, Joe held up one hand. "No, don't tell me. I'll bet I know." He thought about Gus's long, rambling conversations, his easy manner with potential clients, his erratic, extended vacations. He smiled. "You just love what you do. You love talking with people, asking them questions, learning all about them, finding ways you can help them, serve them, fill a need, share a resource." Gus stood up, ambled over to the coat rack, retrieved his tweed jacket, and winked at Joe. "An old man's gotta have some fun." As Gus walked to the elevator door, Joe smiled and called out, "See you at lunch." Gus turned and looked back at Joe, puzzled. "Lunch?" Joe chuckled. "Oh no, this time I have it figured out. You're the connector, right? So you're my lunch date at Pindar's tomorrow. The Friday guest." "Ah, the Friday guest." Gus gave a little laugh. "Me? No, it's not me." He laughed again and stepped into the elevator, talking to himself as he went. The Friday guest. Now that should be fun. Chapter 12. The Law of Receptivity. Friday at 12 o'clock sharp, Joe rapped briskly on the front door of the Great Stone Mansion. He glanced up at the gathering clouds and slipped his hands into his pockets for warmth. Today was the kind of late September day that held more hints of approaching winter than of departing summer. He was about to knock a second time when the door swung open and Rachel appeared. "Joe, come on in," she said, leading him into the study. "The old man had an unexpected phone call. If you don't mind waiting here, he'll be down in just a few minutes." Joe looked around the oak-paneled room with its muted tones and its smells of leather and old books. "You're not going out today," Rachel said in answer to Joe's unspoken question. "Today's the day you dine here." Joe noticed that Rachel said this as if it were part of an established sequence, something she'd explained many times before. "Today's the Friday guest, huh?" Rachel smiled. "Exactly. Can I ask you a question?" Joe had been itching to have this conversation ever since Wednesday when Pindar had told him Rachel's story. "Sure. What's it like working for Pindar?" Rachel hesitated, then smiled at Joe. "Honestly," she sat down in one of Pindar's wingback chairs, "it's been amazing." In the years since she had first come to work at the Stone Mansion, Rachel had learned more about the art of good business than most entrepreneurs would pick up in a lifetime of experience. She learned about finance and philanthropy, negotiation and networking, resources and relationships. "Pindar's principles of cooperative commerce from A to Z," she said with a grin. and she applied all these lessons by throwing herself into the earnest study of her passion, the making of excellent coffee. Starting with a long conversation at Ernesto's Cafe, Rachel had explored the world of restaurant supply, carefully researching the most reliable supply lines to all the best equipment, such as commercial-scale roasters and grinders. She also taught herself to source premium coffee beans from all over the world. She started by getting to know a few individual coffee farmers in Colombia that she had connected with through her Spanish teacher at college, who was Colombian. Quickly picking up the region's different Spanish dialects, she easily made additional contacts in the surrounding countries of Ecuador, Venezuela, Peru, and Brazil. Soon, she widened her network to other continents as well, establishing friendships with growers in Sumatra, Indonesia, Kenya, Yemen. "Do you know how many coffee-producing countries there are on our little planet?" she asked. Joe thought for a moment. 20? "More than 36. And over the last 12 months, I've developed personal relationships with coffee growers in every single one of them." Joe was stunned. With this extraordinary network, Rachel could bypass the brokers and middlemen and tap a worldwide supply of the highest quality coffee at exceptionally low prices. And then there were all the people she'd served coffee to in Pindar's living room over the last 12 months, which brought her contacts with first-class expertise in every aspect of business, from import-export to international financing to management and human resources. In fact, if she wanted to, Rachel could probably walk out of the house and within 48 hours lay the groundwork for a global gourmet coffee empire. "Oh my gosh," Joe blurted out. "Of course." He slapped himself on the forehead and laughed. "Of course what?" A big smile crept over Joe's face. He leaned back in his chair and pointed at Rachel. "Of course. You." "Me," said Rachel. "You. You've been here all week, so it never occurred to me, and it was right in front of my nose the whole time." Rachel arched her eyebrows. "Yes?" Now Joe pointed at Rachel with the index fingers of both hands like a pair of pistols. "You're the Friday guest. Admit it." Rachel sighed and held up her hands as if to say, "I give up, you win." "Good guess." Joe beamed. "But no dice." Joe's smile faded. Rachel cocked her head, listening. "Ah, his phone call's over." She got to her feet. "When you're ready, can you find your way to the terrace? He said you two will sit out and eat lunch while you wait for the Friday guest to arrive." She smiled at the look of consternation on Joe's face and quietly withdrew. Joe slowly shook his head, then got up out of the comfortable chair and headed out to the terrace to join his mentor and await the Friday guest, whoever that might turn out to be. "So what do you think about all this?" For the past 20 minutes, the two of them had enjoyed the most wonderful lunch of cold cuts, fresh breads, and an array of pickles, olives, relishes, and the like. Joe counted 5 different types of mustard, and he had managed to sample every one of them. But he knew Pindar's question was not about the lunch spread. It was about everything he had seen and heard during the week. Joe hesitated, then spoke carefully, as if stepping from stone to stone across a river. "I think it all sounds amazing. Wonderful. Really wonderful." He paused, feeling the spreading warmth of the late September sun. "And?" prompted Pindar. "And I'm just not..." Joe took a big breath and then let it out, unable to finish the thought. "Let me see if I can help here," said Pindar. "When you were young, what did you learn about giving?" Joe frowned in concentration. Pindar interrupted his train of thought before it had even gotten started. "Don't think about it, Joe. Don't try to remember. Just tell me, when I say giving, what's the first thing that leaps to mind?" "It is better to give than to receive." "Exactly. It's better to give than to receive, right? If you're a good person, that's what you do. You give. Good people give and don't think of receiving. But you think about receiving all the time. You can't help it. Which means you're probably not really a very good person. So why bother trying? All this giving stuff sounds great. For some people. For people like me, maybe, or Nicole, or Ernesto. But not for you. It's just not who you are." There was a moment of silence. "Is that how it is?" Joe sighed. "Something like that," he admitted. Pindar turned and looked out at the city stretching off to the west. He seemed pensive, almost sad. he continued, looking into the distance as he resumed speaking. I want you to try something for me. I'm going to count to 30, and while I count, I want you to slowly exhale. That's all. Just exhale and don't stop. Take a good breath in first so you have plenty of air, okay? Now, breathe in and go. And as Pindar began counting, Joe began to slowly let his breath out. By the time Pindar had reached 9, Joe was hunching forward and turning a bit pale. At 12, he straightened up and abruptly drew in a big gasping breath. Pindar glanced at Joe. Couldn't get to 30? Joe shook his head. What would you think if I told you it has been medically proven that it's healthier for you to exhale than to inhale? Would that make a difference? Puzzled, Joe shook his head again. No, of course not. You can't just go on exhaling forever, no matter what argument anyone gives you. What if I told you that it's better for your heart to relax than to contract, to just keep opening up without squeezing down again? Would you give it a try? This time, he didn't even wait for an answer. It's ridiculous, right? Of course it is. And so is that bit of traditional wisdom nonsense that you and I and everyone else had drummed into us. It's not better to give than to receive. It's insane to try to give and not receive. Trying not to receive is not only foolish, it's arrogant. When someone gives you a gift, what gives you the right to refuse it, to deny their right to give? Receiving is the natural result of giving. If you give and then try to stop the receiving that comes back, you're like King Canute watching the tide roll out and commanding it not to come back in. It has to come back in, just as your heart has to contract after relaxing. At this instant, all over the globe, all of humanity is breathing in oxygen and breathing out carbon dioxide. So is the rest of the animal kingdom. And right now, at this instant, all over the globe, the billions and billions of organisms of the plant kingdom are doing the exact opposite. They're breathing in carbon dioxide and breathing out oxygen. Their giving is our receiving, and our giving is their receiving. In fact, every giving can happen only because it is also a receiving. And with that, Pindar abruptly stopped speaking and gazed again out at the city and mountains beyond. Joe sat riveted to the spot, as if in the aftermath of an earthquake. Every giving can happen only because it is also a receiving. For a full minute, neither spoke. Joe heard nothing but the confused rush of blood in his ears. It was as if he could hear the sounds of thought swirling in his brain. Then he became aware of his breathing. In and out, in and out, in and out, and he laughed. A horse. Pindar turned and looked at him quizzically. A horse, Joe repeated, to water. You can lead a horse to water. Pindar cocked his head and waited. But you can't force him to take the water you offer. That's the last law, isn't it? Receiving. Choosing to receive. Pindar said nothing, nor did he move. He just continued to watch and listen. Joe's thoughts started coming in a rush. All the giving in the world won't bring success, won't create the results you want, unless you also make yourself willing and able to receive in like measure. Because if you don't let yourself receive, you're refusing the gifts of others, and you shut down the flow. Because human beings are born with appetite, nothing is more naturally geared toward being receptive than a baby. And if the secret of staying young, vibrant, and vital throughout life is to hang on to those most precious characteristics we all have as children, but which get drummed out of us, like having big dreams, being curious, and believing in yourself, then one of those characteristics is being open to receiving, being hungry to receive, being ravenous to receive. And now Joe's eyes were shining, as were Pindar's, watching him. In fact, all those things I just mentioned, having big dreams and being curious and believing in ourselves, those are all aspects of being receptive. They're all the same thing as being receptive. Being open to receive is like... And here Joe seemed to grapple for a moment. He spread out his arms and looked upward as if searching for a word big enough to convey his thoughts. It's like everything. Joe stopped. Pindar beamed at him for a moment, then spoke. The world certainly was designed with a sense of humor, wasn't it? Inside every truth and every appearance, there's a bit of opposite tucked inside. Just to keep things interesting, Joe mused aloud. Yes, Pindar replied, nodding with delight. That's an excellent way of putting it. Just to keep things interesting, things are always a bit the opposite of what they seem. So the secret to success, Joe went on, to gaining it, to having it, is to give, give, give. The secret to getting is giving, and the secret to giving is making yourself open to receiving. What do you call this law? Pindar raised his eyebrows. What would you call it? And Joe replied without hesitation, the law of receptivity. Pindar nodded thoughtfully. Good. They sat together in silence for a long moment, contemplating the law of receptivity and the glorious irony of creation that tucks its greatest truths carefully inside of paradoxes. Joe had a sudden thought that nearly made him jump. My lunch hour's nearly over. Who are we supposed to see today? Pindar looked over at him. Who are we supposed to see? You know, who was supposed to reveal the last law, the Friday guest? Pindar smiled. Ah, the Friday guest. That would be you, my friend. And he paused and said again, that would be you. The fifth law, the law of receptivity. The key to effective giving is to stay open to receiving.
Chapter 13, Full Circle. That afternoon, the mood was somber on the seventh floor of the Clasenhill Trust Corporation. Third quarter was coming to an end, and all Joe's colleagues were doing the same thing he was. They were trying to conjure some last-minute miracles to bring in just a little more business. Or in Joe's case, a lot more business. But that business had not arrived. Carl Kellerman had called to confirm the bad news. Neil Hansen had indeed been awarded the fat contract Joe called the Big Kahuna, and Joe had not. Joe sat at his desk, gazing thoughtfully at his empty coffee cup, while his co-workers began pulling on their coats and snapping their briefcases shut. It was already after 5. Whatever else they might accomplish would have to wait for October and fourth quarter business. You want to come in off that ledge and talk about it before you jump? Joe looked up to find Gus peering at him from his open office door. Joe gave a half-hearted laugh and motioned for his friend to join him. Gus took a chair by Joe's desk while Joe fiddled with a pencil. Well, Gus, I just lost the account of my career and blew my third quarter numbers. I'm not even sure what'll happen to me now. And the really weird thing about it is... While Gus listened, he pulled his meerschaum from a vest pocket and poked at it. The weird thing is... Of course I feel bad, but not as bad as I should. I mean, I never actually tried to get Pindar's help on this. I never even brought his name up to Carl Kellerman. I suppose I screwed up big time, but if I had to do it over, I think I'd do the same thing, you know? He looked up at the clock on the wall. Exactly 1 week ago, right at this moment, I was asking you for Pindar's phone number. And now, he sighed. Patience, I guess. Gus pulled a small silver lighter from his pocket, put the meerschaum between his teeth, ignited the lighter with a soft snick, and held the flame to the pipe's hard white clay bowl. He puffed a few times until the pipe was well lit, then leaned back. The man was actually smoking a pipe, right here in the office. Gus winked at him. Just a few puffs. He drew on the pipe, then held it away, peered into the bowl, and poked at it with his forefinger. You can't measure your success by whether or not you get the account. That's not the point. No? What is the point then, Gus? Gus took another puff, blew 3 perfect smoke rings, and watched them fade away, then knocked the pipe's contents out into Joe's trash can. The point is not what you do, not what you accomplish. It's who you are. Suddenly Joe felt like crying. I know, it's just... He looked up into Gus's face and was struck by how much his kindly expression reminded him of Pindar's. It's just, I hate to sound so pragmatic and mundane, but what good is all that if it doesn't generate any wins in the marketplace? I could be a saint and starve to death. Joe cast a forlorn glance around the office, looked up at the clock, and suddenly sat bolt upright. Ah, the last law! Gus raised his eyebrows. I'm supposed to apply the law of receptivity. The key to giving is being open to receive. But how am I supposed to do that? How do you go about being actively open to receive? Because I'll tell you, Gus, I am already open to receive, honestly. I mean, I am really, really open. He sighed and hunched back in his chair. At least I thought I was, but it looks like the only thing I'm receiving is the short end of the stick. Gus leaned over and put his hand on Joe's shoulder. Don't worry, Joe. He stood up. Worrying about it does no one any good. You've had a long week. Go home to your wife. I'll stay and close up. Something in Gus's manner made Joe's shoulders relax, and he felt his bleak mood dissipate slightly. He gave his older colleague a wan, tired smile. Thanks, Gus. But you go ahead. I'll get it. Gus shook his head and went to get his coat. You're a different person than you were a week ago, Joe. You know that? He walked to the elevator, pushed the down button, and turned back just as the door slid open. Although this Joe was already inside there, too, just not quite visible yet. He smiled. Good night, Joe. Night, Gus, and thanks. Alone in the office now, his eyes closed, Joe sat, quiet. He could feel the daylight ebbing. Time to close up. He slowly got to his feet. He ambled over to the coffee urn, dumped out the shallow, bitter pool of late afternoon coffee, removed and discarded the cool, damp grounds, rinsed out the big metal cylinder, and began to wash the area around the percolator with wet paper towels. As he washed the cups, drying and stacking them neatly in the cupboard, he thought of Rachel and her illustrious brew. He felt an odd smile of contentment bubble up from inside and spread over his face. He stopped moving and listened to the quiet stillness of the normally busy office. What was it he was feeling? The quiet felt almost as if it were alive, motionless, but listening. It felt, how would you describe it? Receptive. The phone rang. Joe swiveled to stare at it, then at the wall clock. At 6:15? On a Friday? He picked up. Hi, is this Joe? It was not a voice he recognized. I can't believe you're still there. I'm sorry, have we... Joe couldn't place the voice. No, you don't know me. Name's Hansen, Neil Hansen. Ed Barnes gave me your number. Who? Ed Barnes referred me? Are you sure you... And then he remembered. Ed Barnes, the competitor whose name he had given to Jim Galloway. The phone conversation Monday, his first day of homework. Give more in value. Wait, Joe stammered. The Neil Hansen that got that account with... Listen, the man sounded frantic. I'm in a real jam. Joe couldn't believe his ears. The guy who had nailed the BK account without breaking a sweat, an arch competitor, referred by yet another competitor, was now on the phone with Joe because he was in a jam? And Ed said it was a long shot, but I might as well give you a call, that you might know someone, that you'd given him a great referral. I've got a guy about to call me back who works with this huge account. I'm talking seriously huge, and he's in a major bind. This account's lost their supplier, and they need someone fast, because they have this major thing lined up. Who's the account? Asked Joe. He heard the man pause on the other end. You won't believe me when I tell you. He told Joe the name of the account. For a moment, Joe couldn't breathe. It was a name next to which the big kahuna would seem no more than a minnow. This was not a big kahuna. This was a humongous kahuna. Joe felt dizzy. What do they need? He asked faintly. Hang on a second. It's them calling now. Neil Hansen clicked off the line for a moment, and Joe paced as he waited. After 10 or 15 of the longest seconds Joe had ever experienced, the voice came back on the line. Okay, now they're hanging on a sec. All right, here's what we got. They're buying 3 international hotel chains and consolidating them all under one roof, rebranding them with a strong emphasis on business conferences and resorts, and kicking the whole brand off by relaunching a luxury cruise line they purchased as part of the whole package. Get this, in 3 weeks. Joe was afraid to ask. And? And, okay, last minute, they lost a critical concession. The supply people they were working with started getting funny with their pricing structure and finally had to pull out. None of the other suppliers we've tried to put them together with can possibly meet their scale or their quality standards. None of the other guys are big enough. And frankly, none of them are good enough. Whoever can make this happen is going to be sitting on an amazing package. But I can't find anyone who can pull it off, not on this scale, price, and schedule. What's the concession? Joe almost whispered. The other man's voice came back with a defeated, tired, Friday afternoon tone. Premium, top-shelf coffee. I'm talking hundreds of thousands of customers. I'm talking high, I mean mega-high quality at impossibly high volume. 3 weeks. 3 weeks. Nobody's come close. Joe took a long, slow breath, then sat down slowly in his chair. He smiled. You know, he said, I just might know someone. Chapter 14. The Go-Giver. The young woman emerged from the parking garage, blinking in the bright August sunlight. You'll do fine, Claire, she murmured to herself for the third time that morning. She'd been communicating with this company for a few weeks now, but it had been all by phone and email. Today, she was going to meet the man himself. You'll do fine, she repeated, and headed down the block. Claire had done quite a bit of research on this young company in the past few weeks, hoping to gain some insight into exactly what might have catapulted it into such amazing overnight success. It was not quite a year since one of the company's founders had had the good fortune to land the huge contract that launched the business she was about to visit into its stratospheric rise. One of those sweetheart deals that comes along once in a lifetime, if then, was how one magazine article had described it. Yet in the 10 months since, he and his partners had come into one good stroke of luck after another. As young as he was, there was already a reputation circulating about his having a golden touch. Claire arrived at the address she'd been given, a converted factory building in the city's old garment district, surrounded by boutique grocery markets and loft apartments. She peered through the door, and sure enough, there was the name, hand-carved into a large wooden sign in the quaint tile foyer. Rachel's Famous Coffee, 5th floor. She leaned back and glanced up, counting the floors. The 5th floor, that would be the top floor. The sun's glare made her a little dizzy. Doesn't look like their success has gone to their heads, she mused, as she stepped through the tiny foyer and into the ancient elevator. The receptionist at Rachel's Famous Coffee greeted Claire with a warm smile and directed her down a long hall to a door bearing the single word, brainstorming. She knocked twice, softly, then twice again with more assurance. The door swung open as she heard a man's voice exclaim, "Come in!" A beaming, spectacled, round-faced man in his late 30s ushered her into the spacious conference room as he shook her hand. "You must be Claire," said the man. "I'm Hansen, Neil Hansen. It's so good to meet you. My partners and I appreciate all the hard work you've put into your proposal." Claire nearly gasped. The huge, polished hardwood conference table in the center of the room was covered with an elaborate scale model of what looked like a tiny mountainside settlement. On the outskirts of the village, a bank of wind-powered turbines drove a nearly invisible irrigation system that snaked through a series of tiered fields. The designer in Claire marveled at the simplicity and efficiency of the whole thing. It was stunning. "Thank you very much, Mr. Hansen." Claire glanced up at the wall on the other side of the table and saw that it was covered with breathtakingly beautiful photographs, all of them black and white shots of children of varying ages and modes of dress. The man followed her gaze and smiled warmly. "Amazing, aren't they? There's no force more powerful than the trust in a child's face." He walked around the table with Claire as she took in photo after photo. "Many of them are the children of our partners in the different regions where we do business. Rachel took all these herself on her last trip," he added. "She'd be here to meet you, too, but she's out of the country right now, back in Central America, nailing down some key connections for a big project we're launching later in the fall. Big project, I'm talking seriously huge. But hey, you're here to see my other partner anyway, yes?" Claire nodded. "Why don't you go ahead in," said Neil Hansen, gesturing to a connecting door in the next office. "He's expecting you." "Claire, welcome. Thanks for taking the time to see me," said the third founding partner of Rachel's Famous Coffee. "It's an honor, sir," Claire replied as she wondered, "why is he thanking me?" "Please, call me Joe. If you say, sir, I won't know who you're talking to." Claire smiled. Despite her nervousness, something about the man's voice had put her curiously at ease. "All right, Joe. Thank you, said Joe. He showed her to a chair, then took a seat himself. Claire, I want you to know that we all genuinely appreciated your proposal. It's obvious you put a great deal into it. He paused briefly. I need to let you know, he continued, that we've decided to give the fall marketing campaign to your competition. There it was, the moment Claire had been preparing for all morning, yet it still hit her like a thunderclap. I appreciate your telling me in person. You're not surprised? How could I be, sir? I mean, Joe, they're a big firm and I'm a solo freelancer. The fact is, they have a lot more to offer you than I do. Actually, Joe replied, with all due respect, we don't think so. More experienced, yes, and they're excellent at what they do. But frankly, Claire, you're very talented. And what's more, you've got heart. Heart? Claire was confused. I just told you that we're giving this contract to your competition. Your response was to thank me and give them a compliment. You've got heart. In fact, Joe continued, that's why I asked you to meet with us today. The campaign we're giving your competition is an important one, but we've got another project that in the big scheme of things is even more so. My partners and I have started a foundation that is about to launch a major international initiative. The purpose of the Rachel's Famous Coffee Foundation is to work with indigenous communities throughout Central America, Africa, Southeast Asia, all the coffee-producing countries in the world, helping to create community-based, self-sufficient business cooperatives. He paused a moment to let Claire absorb what he was saying. This project is going to make a genuine, lasting difference for communities all around the world. It's going to take a significant amount of money to fund it properly. We need someone to design and coordinate the global effort to raise that money. I know this is a little different from what you've been doing up until now, but we'd like that someone to be you, if you're interested. Claire was too thunderstruck to say a word. Joe nodded, as if Claire had spoken, and continued, Of course you'll need to think about this. What I'd really like is to have my wife, Susan, tell you more about it. She's the smartest civil engineer I know, and we've been lucky enough to persuade her to leave her position with the city and join us. And, he glanced at his watch, she'll be meeting me in a few minutes downstairs to go for lunch. Do you have time to join us? Claire paused, looking for the right words. Sir? Joe? Joe said nothing, but gave a gentle nod as if to say, Go on. How do you do all this? Joe looked slightly puzzled. Do all what? How do you create these amazing situations? It's not even a year since you and your partner started this whole thing. Most people would still be struggling just to get a new business off the ground, and you're already launching massive projects and having a worldwide impact. I guess what I'm saying is, I'm very flattered by your offer, and I'm certainly interested in learning more about the project. Very interested. But what I'm most interested in learning is how you do what you do. It's got to be more than just being lucky or in the right place at the right time. Whatever it is you three have tapped into, I'd sure love to know what it is and how it works. For a moment, Joe seemed lost in thought. Claire was starting to wonder if she'd been too bold and perhaps offended him when he took a deep breath and spoke. A question like that deserves a clear, complete answer, and I promise to give you exactly that, over lunch if you're free to join us. Have you ever been to Ifrates? It's our favorite. Claire heard herself say, Thank you, and No, I haven't. Joe smiled as he got to his feet. There's someone there I'd like you to meet.
Find out how you can be part of the Go-Giver phenomenon by visiting www.thegogiver.com. That's www.thegogiver.com.
This has been a Gildan Audio production.
This audio program is presented by Audible.com. Audible. Audio that speaks to you wherever you are.